Texas Talking. Oh, what was that that you said? Texas Talking. Oh, gonna hoop upside your head. Texas Talking. Tell me, who can you trust when Texas got...
I'm Dr. Brett Giroir with the Texas A&M Health Science Center. No, Evan, I cannot get permission for you to take the Heisman Trophy home over the holidays, but I can get one of our med students to take a look at that rash of yours. And now, here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the TripCast for the third week of December. Joining me is CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve. Merry Christmas.
Executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
It's like the nicest thing I've said to him.
It is, yeah.
Reporter
that was
Jay
your present
Root.
Right there. Yeah.
Hello there.
Yeah.
Well, there's Jay.
Should have said a happy Hanukkah to you, Evan, I suppose.
I don't observe.
It's a little bit late. It's belated.
Don't observe that.
Not there's anything wrong with that.
No, there wouldn't be anything wrong with it, but I'm with you people.
He wanted a December holiday.
What an odd,
it was really early.
What an odd beginning. I hope we haven't, alienated any listeners.
No more than usual.
Okay.
Just the Jews.
Well, let's jump in. Obviously, after Christmas is New Year's, and we will be looking back at the year that was 2013. But Jay, since you're here and you've been following the governor's race, why don't you bring us up to speed on how that's going? Who's ahead?
Well, I think Greg Abbott's ahead. He doesn't have a primary. He really never had.
He does have a primary.
He doesn't have a real primary. He didn't really have a real primary at any time. But Tom Paakin dropping out of the primary, I think, sort of removed a thorn from his side. They weren't
no Hanukkah present for Miriam Martinez for you for saying that this race is over, Jay.
Well, they
didn't you write a story about how the big small fish in the pond was not Tom Paakin but Lisa Fritsch?
Yes, I did. But the Abbott campaign never worried or talked about anybody in the primary except for Tom Paakin, because he was really actively going around and talking to Tea Party groups and trying to stir up a sort of conservative rebellion against Greg Abbott. And you know, it obviously he went nowhere, and so he crashed and burned, and then decided right around the time we were asking for his tax returns that he was not going to. And of course, it was around the filing deadline. But he
it was mostly the tax returns, though.
But he decided not to give us his tax returns or to run for governor. As for Wendy Davis,
I think
Davis,
we should still ask him for his tax returns.
Why not?
Just give him.
Well,
to
actually,
us.
He did flat up refuse.
To be fair, most of the people we asked for their tax returns both refused and are not running for governor.
Although both Wendy Davis, Democrat Wendy Davis, senator from Fort Worth,
state senator,
and Abbott have given us their tax returns. I think Wendy Davis sort of ended the. Ended the year sort of underwhelming the chattering class. I mean, I think there was this great expectation. The expectations for her were really off the charts. They were, so it would have been hard to meet them. I think it's fair to say that she kind of didn't meet the very, very high expectations. There were some critical reports. Columnists here and there said that she wasn't ready for prime time, that she wasn't really stirring it up.
That was in the Valley, right?
Correct. Yeah, Sandy Sanchez in the.
I guess she had an underwhelming appearance in the Valley.
Yeah,
the Monitor didn't care for.
Logistically glitchy, and that she hasn't really figured out how to talk about abortion or how to not talk about abortion without having people notice that she's not talking about abortion. But I do think in the last few weeks of the year, they seem to have righted the ship. I mean, they're pretty aggressive now, and they figured out that it was important to have Wendy's name on some of these attacks instead of just letting strategist Matt Angle or Battleground Texas or some of these other groups be the proxy for her. They realized that putting her name on the press release, on the message, actually helped them out a little bit. So I think that it would have been hard for her to meet the expectations. I don't think she did. I think she was also gone a lot and raising money, I'm told there's going to be a, quote, big number in January for her. I mean, obviously.
So the question on the big number is going to be how much of that money is in-state right. and how much of it's out-of-state.
Because, well, the first question is going to be what's the number?
Well, it will be. Right. But the money will be useful to her in trying to mitigate Greg Abbott's advantage. No question about that. And she's not going to have as much. The theory is she'll have enough to be in the game, right? But then the next question beyond that is how many of those people who've given are people who live in Texas and can therefore vote? Because you want to look at the fundraising number as a measure of two things. Number one, the resources she has to prosecute this race. But second, does it show that there's ample support out there for any Democrat or for her specifically to win? And if those people are from D.C. or San Francisco or New York.
Like Ted Cruz's money was all out of state.
And see, so
your point is that
it's almost always better to take the money, don't you think?
I'm not suggesting she not take the money, and I think that your point about Cruz is a good one, but we both know that the challenge for her, not for him,
right?
The challenge for her is going to be to translate any support she gets financially outside the state into enthusiasm and turnout and votes.
Well, you got to have the resources to run a campaign. And she's got several months before she has to sort of be publicly engaged in a lot of this stuff. And she can spend all of her time right now raising money and building organization and stuff. But, you know, in the same way that Ted Cruz's money came from out-of-state, Club for Growth, Freedom Works, all of those groups, it doesn't matter where the money comes from if you put it to good use. I mean,
and also money is not determining – is not a determinant of success because all of Tony Sanchez's money came from Texas. In fact, it came from one address in Laredo.
Same with David Duer, speaking of Cruz.
We're going to write about the money. We're going to take it very seriously, and we'll write about Greg Abbott's money. We'll write about her money. But my experience has been that the source of the money, unless it's from like a felon or somebody that's really, truly
Medellin cartel.
Yeah, something, you know, I mean, like people gave their Enron money back at one time. Occasionally you see people giving money back. I mean, money can be an issue, but I have often found that it's usually better to take the money than to worry about, you know, if it's coming out of state or whatever. And of course, the Abbott campaign, this has been one of their major attack lines, is that she's getting all her money from these liberal out-of-state sources, and that she's sort of, you know, gone off to San Francisco and New York and all these horrible places.
The best one last week was Battleground Texas had its holiday party in Washington.
Yeah.
Could you imagine such a thing? I mean, oh, come on.
Came here from Washington. Isn't that where Battleground Texas came from?
Look, there's a second. Jay's, I think, articulating exactly what the criticism of the campaign has been. But there's a theory that would counter that some people are now beginning to propagate. That is, she's in sort of a quiet period. She is becoming a candidate, testing her opening the play in New Haven, let's call it that, right? The conventional phrase here. She's testing out her lines in smaller markets. She's raising money. They're strategizing. And that she's got no primary, so there's no imperative for this to be on display today, soon, and that she will come roaring out of the gate having done a lot of organizational work, having done a lot of thinking, and a lot of crafting of message, and that when she is out there, you're going to see something. Now, remains to be seen whether that's the case.
This is basically the argument – I don't disagree with you. This is basically the argument that she's running George W. Bush's 1994 campaign. Let's take him on the road. Let's teach him how to speak to Rotary groups. He was terrible at first, and they ran around, and they kept their heads down. They kept their heads down, and then when they popped up, it was a full-blown organization with all the money they needed, and he had learned how to talk to crowds.
Or, frankly, it's a George P. Bush campaign.
Right.
Not George W. Bush campaign. Tell me where
you just
George...
run for a small office but that no one's paying attention to.
Where is George P. Bush? I mean, honestly, you criticize those who criticize Wendy Davis for being largely absent from any big conversation about issues.
George P. Bush is running for land commission.
But here's the point, though. The point I'm saying is he has basically been as invisible to big media and to the public and to a public conversation as she's been. I grant you there's massive differences between them. I guess the point is it's not unprecedented in this cycle or previously. This is the anti-Burka. This is the up yours Burka argument. Paul Burka at Texas Monthly has been saying,
coming out in favor.
Wendy Davis has been absent. Where's Wendy Davis?
And then there was Where's Wendy too.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is the response to that in some quarters. Well, the argument of Where's Wendy is she's off figuring out, crafting, raising, and in time, she'll be back out.
Right, and there's really no reason to be all over the place this exactly early, right. but there really isn't. But I do think that, you know, there have been a couple of times where, for example, you know, the big one was when she said, I'm pro-life.
Right, and then she instantly caved to the conservative pushback on that. Why not just lean into that? You know, say, I'm pro-life because I support these things that help kids and stuff. Instead, they said, oh, you're not pro-life. And she said, oh, that was out of context. But of course, it wasn't out of context.
Yeah, I mean, there is that you know, what you're articulating is exactly the type of criticism that you hear around here in the chattering class, and we are, I guess, part of the chattering class. But I do think, though, that Karen Johansson, the campaign manager, was not there until she did not – that they had launched their campaign, and I guess it was maybe, I don't know, a month later or more maybe – that she finally came on board. And I think you're starting to see her, you know, get accustomed to being in Texas and get this campaign going. And so I do think that there's sort of a lagging indicator issue, which is that in the last couple of weeks of the year, or 3 weeks, whatever, we've seen a little bit more aggression, and they seem to be attempting to take the fight more to Greg Abbott. You know, it kind of started when Abbott released his education plan. It was like, oh, hell no, we're not going to let him dominate the conversation over education.
And his education plan?
He was more
started like talking about
it. It was a very slow rollout where they're meeting with educators, and then they're going to come back in early January.
Well, how is Abbott doing? You know, does he have expectations to live up to, or is it just sort of he can just do whatever he wants because everyone expects him to float along?
I think he's kind of doing a public Rose Garden campaign. You know, the classic Rose Garden campaign is stay home, don't do anything, the David Dewhurst mistake, right? You know, I'm not going to go out to all of these town halls. I'm not going to do all of this stuff. I'm going to stay above the fray. I'm never going to mention my opponents. And, you know, that's the classic Rose Garden strategy. But Dewhurst showed the hole in that, and Ted Cruz did, by saying he never goes anywhere. He never comes out and talks
to you. Abbott has been traveling.
So Greg Abbott's adapted. And I think he's doing sort of the stay above the fray thing, but he's all over the place sort of with these – you know, it's a very anodyne approach. I mean, he comes out with these education plans, and they're kind of soft and fluffy, and he's in front of the crowd, and he's not really doing anything edgy or anything like that that would cause a campaign conflagration or any kind of a conflict or anything. So you can't say he's not out there, but you can't really say he's out there punching anybody in the nose.
But you've just identified, I think, the perfect contrast with the Davis campaign. So the Davis campaign needs to put her out in front of the attacks on Abbott. Abbott's hands are clean in terms of the attacks on Davis. The attacks on Davis are being done by Abbott's henchmen,
right?
Paid and unpaid around the internet and elsewhere. They're the ones who are attacking Davis. You're never going to see Abbott, or have not yet seen really Abbott attacking her frontally. But it's the people around him who've been attacking her frontally. Look, I want to come back to what Jay said, I think, to square these two, and that is this question of abortion and how she's had to walk sort of gingerly on both sides of this issue. The Republicans would be elated if this campaign between now and November was Greg Abbott versus the abortionist. They're going to do everything they can to have this race as a frame be Greg Abbott versus the abortionist. In fairness to Wendy Davis, but for the filibuster, she was not particularly associated with that issue. But that's her brand, because the celebrity
– She was also not particularly associated with the governor's race.
Well, yeah, but you're missing the point, I think, that her celebrity necessarily is tied to the filibuster. Therefore, her candidacy is necessarily tied to the filibuster. Therefore, her candidacy is necessarily tied to the issue at the center of the filibuster.
Right.
But if you cut off June 25th or 6th, whatever it was, and you go back previous –
Then she's an unknown advocate for education.
But what she was not, though, was the loudest voice on that issue.
So
she actually filibustered on education previously. There were other issues she was associated with. I guess my point here is she has to own the brand, right?
If you just ignore her history with the abortion issue, then she is not associated with it at all.
My point is that she has to transcend that moment that was the rocket booster for her celebrity. It's a tough act
She has to
it's
be
a tough act to manage.
She has to be about more than one thing.
She has to be about more than one thing, and right. it behooves her, as you made the point on the education issue, to pick one thing. That is an issue that she was associated with on a previous filibuster.
That was
her
main issue. Yeah.
That was a big issue. And that's an issue that has bipartisan credibility. If you look at the way that money went back into public education, that the testing issue that got resolved in this last session, more parent choice, stopping short of vouchers, those were issues that got resolved with relatively little controversy compared to others because there was bipartisan support for those. She's trying to tap into that bipartisan support, and if she can somehow embrace education as the principal aspect of her candidacy, that inures to her benefit.
I don't think she can change the subject.
I think it's hard, though. I agree with you.
But I don't know that she should. I mean, you know, if you're known for this and the energy behind your campaign was about this issue, why would you abandon that energy? This is the horse that got you here. Just figure out how to talk about it.
That's right. I mean, the last thing you said is very – just figure out how to talk about it. Because when they launched the campaign, the day that they – that on October 3rd when she announced – never was the filibuster or abortion mentioned at all. Right. So there was like a really – I think that they swung a little too far in the other direction of like, we're never going to talk about this again. There was that feeling and, you know, whether that was really happening or not, it's certainly that notion sort of set in. And what I think that you've seen them try to do, and we'll see if they're successful at it, is to tap into this idea that she's a fighter. She's taking on this establishment, which means all kinds of things, the cronyism. They can sort of put everything through that funnel. But again, you know, it's like you're going to say, oh, you're for late term, you're abortion.
But there's there's a way to talk about this, to do exactly what Jay and Ross are talking about. There is a way for her, I think, to spin this potentially. And that is to make this less about abortion and more about the idea of the establishment and men, particularly in the establishment, messing with women. She needs to get every Democratic vote she possibly can. She needs to get the majority of independent votes, and she needs to get some Republican women to cross over, either publicly say that they're for her or to get into the voting booth when the curtain is closed and say, you know what, I'm tired of men largely in Austin telling me what I can and cannot do with my body. This is the to get your hands off me is the nice way to say it. The get your hands off me vote in some quarters that may not have been Democratic quarters particularly. That really – the whole point of having Davis and Vandepute as the first 1-2 punch that are women at the top of the ticket for the Democrats. Historically, this is a first. And with Vandepute's line that night, which I think becomes the thematic basis prospectively for the campaign.
Well, Vandepute's very good at it. She's figured out how to talk about this stuff.
But I think that's what does a woman have to do to have her voice heard above the men in this chamber? The word abortion is nowhere in that deal. It's appealing to the idea that somehow women are getting a raw deal, and you tie back into governor's veto of the
Equal
Pay Act.
Yeah, the women's health
stuff.
Program.
It's larger now. The Abbott campaign is going to try to make it only about abortion, but the Davis campaign, prospectively, can address this issue, not run from it, run toward it, but broaden it to be more about women being messed with.
Well, we've talked about this before. It's a framing issue.
So
when you get into the race between Abbott and Davis, and I really think that it's going to be a little while before we're fully into that race, and probably ought to be. Voters aren't going to be paying attention.
When you say a little while, there's not that much time left.
Well, I think it's going to be post-primary.
After March.
Dude, there's a year left.
And then you hit the summer. Kind of everyone's in Colorado and New Mexico.
Right. I think you're going to have – it's really going to be like late summer that it's going to – I mean, I think it's going to be aggressive a lot quicker in the new year, okay? But it's not going to get just blanketed until –
Well,
September.
The other part is she needs to define.
August, whatever,
she needs to define her biography before they define her.
Well,
biography.
It's not biography here. This is an issue thing. This is the they've got to define the issue. Is this about women's health clinics and women's issues, or is this about abortion? And that's really the framing fight. And if we're in September or October of next year, and it's all about abortion, then the Republicans won the framing fight. And if it's about the other thing, then the Democrats won the framing.
Yeah, but
fight.
Jay's point about her being, I agree with you.
Right.
Jay's point about her being a fighter, though. The up from the bootstraps, look at the adversity that I transcended.
I think their resumes wash.
I don't disagree with you. No, they both have adversity. No,
I mean they both got.
But she needs to define.
A tree fell on him.
But she needs to define I of course that's going to be a much more visible sign of adversity.
You don't think she's defined her biography when her profile's in Texas Monthly and Vogue and everywhere else?
How many people are reading Vogue in Texas?
Todd,
I think she needs to to own. How many years have we watched politics and said that the problem with a lot of campaigns that are attempting to be insurgent is that the other campaign, in squashing the insurgent campaign, defines that candidate before the candidate defines
himself
first.
That's Rick Perry and Kay Hutchison, right?
Right. She can't allow Abbott to do to her what Perry did to Hutchison.
And it's the same guy running the campaign.
Defeat.
Right?
The same guy running. Well, he's about half the size now.
Well, Carney will run. I mean, Carney is really good at running. In the same way that Rove did, running
Dave Carney,
not at the weakness of
political
the opponent,
consultant.
But at the strength of the opponent, and undermine their strength, and then the weaknesses become apparent. And you know, the reason I think the resumes wash, I mean, they both have these, you know, great narrative stories about how they overcame adversity and got to where they are. They both are accomplished lawyers, yada yada yada. And I think that basically, okay, you got one. Okay, so let's go to differences. Let's don't go to similarities. And the differences are going to be in these issues. I think this is one of those weird campaigns where the difference between the candidates is actually about ideology and policy rather than about, you know,
style points.
Personal qualities.
Like the Republican primaries for these high-ticket offices, lieutenant right. governor and so on.
Well, but the Wendy biography and the sort of the Wendy story has ever since the filibuster, obviously, which is what made it, took on a life of itself. And so people have these expectations of Wendy. And one of the things that I've come across is that people go, wait, God, I was expecting more sort of a forceful presence. And she, you know, she's sort of a small person physically. And she kind of, her voice doesn't project. She really needs to have a microphone. But I've seen moments, like, for example, the National Press Club, I thought she was really, really good there. When she is leaning into the sort of fighter psychology and is really criticizing the other side and saying, for years we put up this, and sort of from the female perspective, I think it's more powerful. I thought, you know, I had people come to me after her appearance at the Texas Tribune Fest, and they were like, she just didn't seem to be very aggressive, because she's known for having confronted the establishment and actually stopped a socially conservative bill.
They want Aaron Brockovich or Norma Rae.
They want a fighter.
If she doesn't
give them that fighter and doesn't come across that, she's not even going to come close.
And she does. She's not she doesn't make jokes the way an Ann Richards or Molly Ivins or these great, but, you know, liberal Texas Democratic women have done in the past.
But I did, like, you know, go back to the National Press Club appearance and some other appearances that I've seen. She knows how to do this, and it's basically when it's her standing against the establishment.
The point here is that of all the things that she said in the months she's been on the campaign trail now, nothing has been memorable or as memorable as Mama Ain't Happy. Van de Putte,
on
the very first day of her candidacy, said something and articulated it in a way that was more memorable than anything Davis has said so far, which could be a problem for Davis unless they're joined.
I think Van de Putte's going to be the edge of the knife here. I think that Van de Putte's going to be – she's the one who can crystallize this stuff and get it all down to a thing, and she walks into a room. I mean, granted, the announcement speech that she made was on home turf, San Antonio, gym and everything.
But it's pretty good, though.
But she's got some charisma, and she can connect
really
with the crowd, and she has – twice now crystallized the idea. So she did it on the Senate floor that night. She did it in this thing. You know, she's the one who can say, okay, look at all of this stuff. Here's your sentence.
So we think it'll be a real race then?
Which?
The governor's race.
It'll be a real race. I mean, you got to handicap it for the Republicans. There's a built-in organizational and sort of historical bias built into Texas that the Democrats have to overcome. They've got to light up counties where people don't vote. El Paso County is the same size as Collin County and votes about, you know, a third as many people. They've got to solve problems like that are mechanical political problems.
Well, we need to redefine this podcast as not just about the Greg and Wendy race and move on to higher ed and give a little UT update, since we talked about that last week. And there's been a lot of changes.
Is there still a UT?
Since then. Well, for now. You know, we'll see how the end of the year goes. But obviously, so there was a hearing at which Bill Powers, who's the president of UT Austin, who many people have speculated might lose his job at the hands of the current Board of Regents, his job was up for a vote, and they opted to not vote on it. But the chancellor of the UT system, Francisco Sigueroa, gave a little – he made a recommendation that Powers stick around, but he also said – But this guy's been really hard to work with. Our relationship is no good. And if he's going to stick around for a while, then he really needs to work on improving that. And I was wondering, as someone who was not at the meeting, how that came across, Evan.
My reaction was, damn. You know, I thought, all right, so a guy keeps his job. But I think it's exaggeration to say that Chancellor Cigarroa ran the car over Powers, and then just to be sure he got him, he put it into reverse and backed over him a second time. But I thought it was a public rebuke.
If you were Bill Powers, there's no way you're happy about that. I mean, they say you can keep your job, and here's all the things you're doing wrong. You get a D on your report card, you can stay in school.
See,
as somebody who doesn't follow this near as closely, probably as anybody in this room,
I was the only person who went to UT here.
Well, I didn't know that they had such a bad relationship. That was honestly new. I mean, what I was thinking was that the regents are, you know, sort of doing Rick Perry's bidding a little bit, and they're all leaning on Powers. I mean, it's just sort of the 30,000-foot view here. And
Jay's
the
Cigarroa
was a little bit trapped between them. And, you know, I could see how it would be politically delicate for him that he's got to play both sides of it a little bit. But I thought he was leaning a little more to Powers than he was toward the regents.
Well, the suggestion has been made, Reeve, that he was reading a statement, that you could just see the captors off – screen from
holding
the hostage
up
video.
Newspaper, right?
Right, yeah. That somehow Cigarroa was reading words he didn't believe. Sure didn't seem like that to
me. Well, he was reading a statement, but that's because that's all they ever do in board meetings is read statements.
It didn't seem like he was reading somebody else's words.
I think Cigarroa was being very honest, and I think the UT people should be very happy about it. I mean, I think everyone.
UT people meaning the pro powers camp.
The pro powers people should be very happy.
This is a good resolution to
it. Totally.
Is it? So is it over?
Well, I mean, backing up a little bit, I think if you're. I think Cigarroa, from his perspective, and Powers' reputation in general, is that he can be tough for the chancellor to work with. You know, he sort of wants to run the university his own way, and he's a smart guy and a strong-willed guy. And Cigarroa said, you know, our relationship is strained, and they've had a strained relationship, or they've had not much of a relationship in recent months at least, because Cigarroa says, because he is stuck between Powers and the regents. And in that role, he has frequently sort of tried to craft deals to keep the ball moving forward. And he said, every time I do that, Power will come to some sort of agreement, and then I will act on that agreement, and then Powers will go and publicly complain about it, showing demonstrating misalignment, and he's just fed up with it. So I think he was reading a very honest statement. You've seen this when the regents were going to freeze, or they did freeze, UT's tuition.
Right.
And so Cigarroa negotiated a deal where the board would give UT the money that they would have made from a tuition raise. And then Powers came in behind him and said, you know, I'm disappointed in this, blah, blah, blah. And of course, Powers should be free to express disappointment. But the thing is, Cigarroa was frustrated with him repeatedly conveying that there's misalignment when he thinks that they've worked out some sort of deal. You saw this when Cigarroa came out with his framework for advancing the system, which he was very proud of. A couple weeks after that, or if that even, Powers came out and gave his House Divided speech where he said that we're House Divided. So every time it seems like, okay, we've worked out some thing so that we can keep moving forward. You know, the UT people in many cases have actually kept the rift open. And I think that can be frustrating if you're Cigarroa. So I think he was just giving an honest statement, and it's perfectly valid feedback. And at the end of the day, Bill Powers is going to wake up the next morning and be president for the foreseeable future. When we were all in the room waiting for their decision, the question was, okay, the big question was he going to get to stick around with an end date or not? You know, there was a talk of, okay, we'll give him a vote of confidence, but he has to be out by next October. So this way, there's no end date. He
you
gets
take
to be
that
president.
That as a vote of confidence?
No, but you know who else didn't get a vote of confidence? Every other president in the state that
day. But every other president wasn't at risk of losing his job. In the run-up to this thing, what we had heard was, oh, never mind the fact that he was told not to go to New York with Patterson and Mack and was told he had to stay here for this regents meeting at which they were going to do a proctological examination of his tenure as president. It's all going to be fine because a couple of the pro-powers regents have orchestrated a vote of confidence so that we're going to put this issue off the table. It was not that.
It read to me.
No, but it is off the table now. Now, if you are an anti-Powers regent and you say, let's get rid of him, everyone else can say, we gave you your shot to get rid of him. He was on the agenda, and now couldn't get your votes together.
Were the votes not there?
It certainly seems that way.
The conventional wisdom has been that the votes are there.
The conventional wisdom on that changes every day. But the message that Cigarroa basically gave and the other regents gave was, even the ones that don't like him, they recognize that they're in a position where they cannot fire him because he has too much support among the students, faculty, and staff. That's basically what Sigueroa said.
And alumni.
You don't think Sigueroa laid the predicate for Power's eventual demise?
That's kind of the way it just read to me.
You know, it's like, you know,
you're on a tight leash now, friend.
Exactly. No, Powers
has to be a good citizen, is what he said. He has to, cooperate with what the system initiatives are.
I just think there's a difference between reading him out publicly and reading him out privately. And I thought he read him out publicly and he basically said, you know.
And we don't know what the back room conditions were.
Hasn't he been read out privately?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I think we've now gone to the next place.
But he also, you know,
it was a vote of tepid confidence. There was no vote.
But it was also he gets to be president for the foreseeable future.
Right.
If he doesn't keep making House divided speeches, then maybe he'll get to be president for quite a while. But, you know, the thing is, sometimes you do have to make those speeches if you want to be honest and sort of promote the make sure you're having a quality university.
It's a tough situation for
Powers, but I don't think that the Powers people should look at this as. You know, I mean, I think to expect a vote of confidence from this board for Bill Powers would have been like absurd.
Well, and we only expected it because that was the story on the street in the run up, and we were just foolish to believe it.
But I think
now he has to look at everything he says now is like because he's sort of on thin ice, and if Sigueroa doesn't like what he does, it's all over. But the shower.
Yeah, but that's no different from how it actually was before. I mean, you know.
I just didn't know that it was the feelings were so raw. I mean, when I looked at it, I was like, wow.
So we're moving forward, and now the question of whether or not he's going to stick around has basically been answered. Yes, he's going to stick around. Other than that, nothing has changed, and that's good for the Powers people. And basically, there was an admission that the Powers supporters have won the day.
Other than the stuff we're talking about, it was relatively not dramatic, right? I mean, we sort of expected going in that Powers would come out the other end as president, and we came out the other end as president.
Right, and really all the drama is actually going on at the other system, which we should talk about for a second.
That's what I was saying. It's like who would have expected at the beginning of the week that the real drama related to the president of a major public university would be in College Station? That's kind of the way this stuff works. It's always surprising.
We really have no time to talk about this, but Ross, can you talk about it for a second?
So Perry had a candidate. John Sharp, the chancellor, had a candidate. They were in I guess this only took 4 days.
I think it's not over.
Well, I think it's not over too. But so for 4 or 5 days, they basically lobbied the regents, vote for Perry's candidate, vote for Sharp's candidate.
This is for interim president.
This is for interim president of Texas A&M. Mark Hussey, who's one of the super deans at A&M, got the job. He's the one with the academic credentials. Guy Diedrich,
one of the mediocre deans.
Right. Guy Diedrich wanted. Was up for the job. He's a vice chancellor there. He has a PhD, but he's not an academic in the sense that he's been teaching and writing and all of that kind of stuff.
He's been a lobbyist.
He's basically a lobbyist for the school.
You can get a PhD in lobbying?
So apparently so.
That's
so
awesome.
I think what they set up was Perry got a vote count here and got to look at where everybody stood, and now we've got a permanent president race, and I think that this, you know.
So you don't regard this as Sharp 1, Perry 0?
No, I regard this as round 1, Sharp.
Well, the issue was that one guy was a dean and the other guy was, like you said, not academically qualified. Right. I think Guy Diedrich is actually a very competent guy. He probably would make a fine interim president. But the thing is that Sharp was able to get a candidate with the qualifications for the job and Perry wasn't.
Hussey is not going to be
Hussey doesn't want the permanent job.
So does Guy Diedrich come back around?
Guy Diedrich was on the list.
Stay tuned to see what happens to Guy Diedrich. I know there's some talk of putting him in a sort of advisory position to the board.
So he's going
to
be the new Jay Kimbrough?
Possibly. Right. Or he also has a job.
He's the vice chancellor
for strategic initiatives.
But Guy Diedrich will not be a candidate for the permanent presidency of the university.
Well, it'll be hard to see how he gets it after the sort of pushback this time around, but, you know, you never know. Perry really wants him to have some power over there, obviously.
Right.
Next president of Texas A&M, you ready? Mac Brown.
Why not?
Well, Evan Smith, ladies and gentlemen.
He needs a job.
Oh, are you kidding?
I don't think he does need a job.
Mac Brown got a pretty sweet deal.
You think he's got a sweet deal?
Much better deal than Bev Kearney got when she left.
Perfect place to end the podcast. Yeah.
No, Mac Brown gets to be he gets to be advisor to the president for like $500,000 a year until 2020.
Who's going to be our top salary guy on the Texas Tribune salary list?
Well,
now.
After Mac Brown, it's Rick Barnes, but I'm not sure that Rick Barnes is not.
Tick-tock.
Exactly. If I were Rick Barnes.
I would not have laid odds that Rick Barnes would outlast Mac Brown. I just wouldn't have.
Well, if you wouldn't have, then let's just end the podcast. Let's just move on. On behalf of Evan Ross and Jay and Todd, I would like to invite you to send any questions or comments to tribcast@texastribune.org. And I'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music.
We're going to be back next week, or is this it?
This is it for the year.
It is?
Yeah, so say your piece.
Happy Hanukkah, Reeve.
Thank you.
Ta-ta.
She said, this is her whole thing. She said, won't vet. Yeah. I said, what do you mean? She said, won't vet. She just kept saying it, won't vet.